We learn from the moment we're born to the moment we die. Each moment is a mystery to be solved, a question to be answered. We work constantly to replace random chance with rules of thumb. Life demands understanding. Change, also like breath, begins inwardly and finishes outwardly. Breathe in, breathe out. Breathe in good processes, good personnel, good technologies to support them both. Breathe out improved clinical outcomes for patients, operational outcomes for the enterprise, and financial outcomes for the community. Welcome to Steps to Value, a podcast that explores the intersection of people, process, and technology in healthcare as that industry moves towards a value-focused model. I'm your host, Rod Pihowski, and in today's episode, we'll talk to 2016 Davies Award-winning Children's Hospital of Orange County. We discuss how they were able to optimize the people, process, and technologies tasked to care daily for 1 in 100 kids in the U.S. All that and more coming up. Long-term and post-acute care roundtable helps shape the direction of HIMSS in serving the needs of LTPAC providers and vendors. The LTPAC roundtable meetings focus on topics relevant to the LTPAC IT community to include professional development, public policy initiatives, interoperability, and the value of health IT. Get involved today. Go to HIMSS.org and click on the link for the long-term and post-acute care roundtable at the top of the page.
Dr. Jim Capon is Chief Quality Officer, and Caroline Steele is Director, Clinical Nutrition and Lactation Services at Children's Hospital of Orange County, or CHOC. CHOC Children's Hospital is a 2016 Davies Award winner. Jim, Caroline, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
So for those that are new to Children's Hospital of Orange County, can you give us an overview of your organization and its patient population?
Happy to. CHOC, as we call ourselves, is a freestanding children's hospital, academically affiliated, and it really covers the gamut of all pediatric patient care services from primary care, or the classic going to the doctor, all the way through what we call quaternary care, which is the highest level of support and intervention that exists in the planet. We live in Orange County, California. Orange County is America's seventh or eighth largest, which means that there are a lot of children, approaching 1 million, that live in Orange County, and that's our population base. We serve kids from 0 to 21 years routinely, and then we increasingly have a population of young adults that we care for who have had childhood diseases that now move into that third decade of life, and we care for them as well. For perspective, one out of every 100 kids in America lives in Orange County, California.
Wow.
So there's quite a responsibility, quite a duty we have to serve those children well.
Healthcare-acquired infections affect clinical outcomes, patient satisfaction, and an organization's financial bottom line. How has CHOC responded to healthcare-acquired infections like urinary tract infections, and what lessons would you share with others that are trying to deal with the same problem?
Well, in your introduction to that phase, you sort of described the triple aim of healthcare these days, which is good outcomes, population health, and financial responsibility and keeping costs down. So it's interesting, the children's health world, many of the adult-based metrics and, frankly, penalties for poor performance haven't trickled down in quite the same way yet to the children's world, in part because we're less than 10% of the overall healthcare spending and budget and responsibility of the United States. But it's interesting. I'm an intensive care physician, and we used to believe fully that problems like hospital-acquired infections were simply part of the cost of doing business. They were inevitable. Some people were luckier than others. some people's luck ran out. And that's completely changed. That's all become now the idea that getting to zero, very, very close to it, is a fully, it's not an irresponsible tenet. It's scientifically proven that we can approach that, that many of these things that we used to think were unavoidable are in fact avoidable. And in those cases where it's not avoidable, we can at least reduce the risk of the impact and improve the outcomes. Our world has gone from the sense of random chance that caused that person to get an infection, for instance, is now been replaced by bundles and checklists and personal accountability. It's a different world. So in the hospital-acquired infections, like you mentioned, catheter-acquired urinary tract infections, we know that we can take those down towards a near zero rate. We've almost eliminated catheter-associated urinary tract infections in the hospital, which doesn't seem possible. But in part because we've become smarter about not everybody has to have an indwelling catheter all the time, which was part of the routine. You just stuck a catheter in somebody and said, that'll make you better. Well, that made some people better, and it made some people worse. Mm-hmm. And we found out that overall their care was improved if we get rid of those as well. So it's shortened the amount of time that we've put these catheters in place, which has helped quite a bit. We haven't had a ventilator-associated pneumonia for working on a year and a half now. Now, the term itself is being phased out of healthcare because it's got a tough definition, but the bottom line is that those were routine parts, again, of intensive care therapy, and they can go away. I would say the biggest challenge for healthcare-acquired infections in our world continues to be surgical site infections because of the diversity of the patient population, the diversity of the kinds of surgeries you're doing, and because of surgical site infection, the surgeon's still on the hook for 90 days post-operatively. And there's a lot of living that goes on in 90 days.
Absolutely. So part of one of the main areas of focus for the Davies Award is looking at how organizations leverage their people, processes, and technology effectively to drive clinical outcomes, drive financial and organizational outcomes. In 2009, CHOC had 5 evidence-based care guidelines in place that you had embedded into existing care workflows. And within 2 years, that number had moved to 20 around such high-impact areas as asthma. Can you walk us through the change management process? How did the organization respond to this rapid implementation?
I think the success of the current evidence-based medicine or care guidelines process was based really functionally in the implementation of CPOE and thus the expansion of the electronic health record, and not just because I'm at a health information conference. So we started doing our first aspects of EHR in 2002, but we implemented the CPOE in 2007. And before we implemented, we did a couple things right in retrospect. First of all, we wrapped the whole thing in patient safety. We said this is going to improve patient safety. And we had to have some upside to it because there were so many downsides. You know, it takes longer, it's more work, it's not as intuitive and so forth. But that was clearly an upside. We also, very importantly, started CPOE with about 150 order sets. So we got the right people in the room and we said, how do we take care of blank or blank? Things we do all the time. And so we made these order sets. And order sets were a gigantic success of the early EHR and CPOE because they were unquestionably a time saver. Now, they also happened to be very standardized, so we were reducing variation at the same time. But they were a time saver. So then, a couple years later, when we sort of said, you know what, we can do better with care guidelines and evidence-based medicine, this idea of creating standardization, a template, suggesting what best care might look like, and every time including an order set with that care guideline was no longer foreign or automatically taken back as a restriction of liberties or whatever the old saw was in medicine. You know, in medicine they say the ideal size of a team is one, and there's something to that. But we've changed a bit. So we decided to have an active care guidelines process. I happen to be a part of it. And what we did was we went after our highest volume, our highest risk, or our highest variability clinical functions in the organization, and decided to see which of those would fit with a care guideline. And we're now up to about 40 of these. We have another 10 or so what we call evidence-based statements, which are really a smaller problem in medicine that doesn't need a care guideline, which defines an entire encounter, but just a small aspect. And we went into it with the idea that we would eliminate unnecessary variation. It would be evidence-based to the degree of being publishable. And from the very word go, we have published these internally and externally and made them accessible to the nation or the world. And then lastly, we made them fairly simple. In other words, a template for a care guideline is a one-pager, and they all look more or less the same. And they all are linked to an order set and vice versa. So if you have bronchiolitis, which is baby bronchitis, if you want to call that, and you want to go the order set, you do that straight out of the care guideline. Or if you're in the care guideline, you can link straight to the order set. And we track how many of our patients with a given diagnosis, in fact, have the order set in place, because we know, less so in our own institution, but from the work of others, that if you follow the evidence-based guideline correctly for the same disease in a medical surgical environment, so outside the ICU, that you will save something on the order of $3,000, $3,500. Wow. Plus, you're doing the same thing all the time. That makes it much easier for the entire team to know what's going on. It also makes it easier for the families to know what to expect, because we can tell them how we see this going from the very first moment that we meet them.
So it sounds like there's been an effect to both the clinical culture and the patient culture based on this change.
I think so, and you point to something that's interesting there when you talk about the clinical staff as well as the patient staff. Of course, engagement is one of those words these days, and we measure customer engagement, customer satisfaction all the time. But we will suggest to you, and we've coming to believe it, we're still early in this journey, but you can't have patient safety until you have employee safety. You've got to have health and wellness in your staff to do the same thing for your patients. It's not that they'll, you know, we don't intend not to deliver that. It's just that you've got to be consistent with that messaging. So there is one of the newer movements in the health industry is actually making sure that we're taking care of our employees and providing them with great opportunities to be healthy and live well, both at home and at work. And then that flows into the environment we're trying to create for our, among other things, our patients. And in the children's world, patients always come with families.
So with the priorities that come with a strong newborn and infant patient population, safe breast milk handling is, I'm sure, a patient safety concern at CHOC. Can you share with us the clinical and operational implications of the evolution of your breast milk handling protocol and the governance around that?
Sure. As many organizations have pointed out, the American Academy of Pediatrics and others, we now know that human milk is the best feeding for babies. And so we really wanted to maximize that. And what we realized is the more you promote it and the more breast milk you're handling, then your greater risks are there because of a safety aspect. To give you an idea, we handle 116,000 ounces of mom's own milk in a year. Wow. So we are preparing and handling a lot of milk. It is a bodily fluid, so we want to make sure we're, unlike formulas, that we're getting the right milk to the right baby at all times. And so the safe breast milk handling was something, as we worked toward getting more moms pumping and breastfeeding, that we really wanted to delve into. And it was one of those areas that until we dug in, we didn't know what we didn't know. And so, for example, if a nurse were to feed the wrong milk to a wrong baby and throw the bottle away, that nurse might never know that the wrong milk got to the wrong baby. And so what we realized was we needed more than just a visual double check to make this happen. And so as we went through our journey, we did things like centralizing our handling of breast milk, years ago in the hospital and in the NICU particularly, nurses would prepare their own medications. Well, we learned over time that that wasn't the best practice, that pharmacy needed to be compounding and drawing it up in syringes. And we started to apply that same principle to infant feedings. Instead of the nurse thawing milk and adding additives and labeling it and checking it, that nurse needed to be focused on the medical care of the patient, and that we could centralize that and have our own preparation area. We also knew that that would reduce the risk of contamination, because you'd have a central space that was under aseptic technique to handle that, and that finally we could leverage technology to really improve that process. And so we implemented barcode scanning. It was similar to what we were doing with medication and with blood and with specimens, where we could identify each bottle that came into our facility from the time the mom brought it in until we either fed it or sent it home at hospital discharge. And so it really allowed us to improve that safety and make sure that they were getting the right milk, that we were sending the right milk home with them. And it also helped us identify other potential problems, like not letting that milk expire. It's just like food in your fridge. If it has too long of a shelf life, you run the risk of bacterial growth. And so what we didn't want to do is have milk that wasn't used within the time it should be. And so by scanning, it would let us know, is this milk still within a safe time frame, and is it going to the right patient?
So it sounds like you were leveraging some processes that were in place elsewhere, and did having those processes that you were building from already in place, how did that impact the change management around this process?
So what I always like to say is that technology is not a replacement for having good processes. And so what really helped us was to determine where our gaps were and implement process before we put technology in. Sometimes I think we think technology will save our lives and save the world without having a good process in place. And so we knew it wasn't a substitute for clinical competence or for good processes. And so as we were building this, we really sat down and said, where are all our potential failure points and what's the cause of them? And then looked at how, from a staffing standpoint and from a process standpoint, we would fix that, and then moved into technology. So what's at every point it could fail? What could we do from a manual process? And then what did we need technology for? And because we know there's downtimes, you have to have that good manual process in place in case your system goes down, so everybody knows what they're supposed to do.
Well, we've got one last question for you, hoping to get both of your perspectives on this. This podcast is about the relationship between humans and technology. I'm wondering, what is your favorite technological invention, and what impact do you think it has on our culture? Doesn't have to be in healthcare.
Well, I have two related. My dad is a rocket scientist, so maybe this bends into that. But I think GPS was an amazing advance, because it led with precision to that sense of where you are. And I think knowing where you are is hyper important to knowing where you might be. The other aspect of that, my other choice, is the Hubble Space Telescope. Because when you look out with incredible clarity and see where you're not, I think that's very powerful. And so much of what we do, medicine is a humbling, humbling business. And there's so much variability. And as we look out through the window here, Adam, and we see all this wonderful possibilities for the future through these companies that are represented out there on the floor, there's a lot of variability, a lot of things we don't understand. And we're going to sit in rooms like this in 20 years and go, did we really think that back then? Because it's changing right that fast. And so the Hubble Space Telescope really gives me always a sense of perspective and a sense of awe as to just the things that we don't even know yet and can't even begin to think.
Caroline, same question. Favorite technological invention and its impact on our culture?
So I would say, and mine's sort of a global, the smartphone, but I would also say the personal computer to its evolution in the smartphone. And Jim and I were having this discussion before we met with you about what things were like when we were in school and in our early practice versus now, and just the ability to know where to go for information as opposed to either having to memorize it or having your pocket stuffed full of all the reference materials we used to carry around. And when I think of the capacity in our smartphone, it has GPS, it has your phone, you can look anything up. I mean, in the palm of your hand that even 10 years ago we didn't have is pretty amazing, and I think it's really changed our culture.
Jim Capon is Chief Quality Officer, and Caroline Steele is Director, Clinical Nutrition and Lactation Services at Children's Hospital of Orange County, a 2016 Davies Award winner. Jim, Caroline, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Joanne Bartley. I bring value to HIMSS members through supporting those focused on business solutions in healthcare. You're listening to Steps to Value.
So how does your organization learn to drive better achieved outcomes? Send us your thoughts as a voice memo or an email, and we'll play it on the air or read it at the end of our next episode. And you can send your comments to value@hims.org. We'd like to thank our guests, Dr. Jim Capon and Caroline Steele, for sharing their perspectives on the decisions and actions that drove Children's Hospital of Orange County's Davies Award win. More information on everything discussed by today's guests can be found at this episode's landing page at hims.org/steps-to-value. Steps to Value is a HIMSS North America production. The series is co-produced by Adam Baser. Kelly Lippitt is our guest relations manager. I'm Rod Pihowski. See you next time on Steps to Value.